This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. The rise in global food prices has sparked a number of protests in recent weeks, highlighting the worsening epidemic of global hunger. The World Bank estimates world food prices have risen 80% over the last 3 years, and that at least 33 countries face social unrest as a result. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has warned the growing global food crisis has reached emergency proportions. In recent weeks, food riots have also erupted in Haiti, in Niger, in Senegal, Cameroon, Burkina Faso. Protests have also flared in Morocco and Mauritania, Ivory Coast, Egypt, Mexico, and Yemen. In most of West Africa, the price of food has risen by 50%, in Sierra Leone, 300%. The World Food Program has issued a rare $500 million emergency appeal to deal with the growing crisis. Several causes factor into the global food price hike, many linked to human activity. These include human-driven climate change, the soaring cost of oil, and a Western-led focus on biofuels that critics say turns food into fuel. Raj Patel is a writer, activist, and former policy analyst with Food First, which is based in the Bay Area. He's worked for the World Bank, World Trade Organization, the United Nations, and he's also protested them on four continents. He's just come out with a new book called Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. He recently joined me in San Francisco when I was in New York to talk about the book and the food price crisis. This is the second part of our interview.
There are two kinds of stories that we can tell about the food prices. One is an economic story, and that's a story about a perfect storm of poor harvests and a demand for meat in developing countries, which is diverting grain, and a high price of oil, which is driving up food, sort of farm inputs. At the same time, the biofuels boom, the process of growing fuels in order, growing food in order to burn it rather than eat it. All of these are economic factors that are driving up the price of food. But at the same time, there's a political story here, and it's a longer-term political story about how countries have been forced to abandon their support for farmers and to abandon things like grain supplies and grain stores. This is a longer-term story, and it involves organizations like the World Bank and the World Trade Organization that have a sort of fairly iron control over the economies of most of the poorest countries in the world. And what the World Bank and what the WTO and, to some extent, the International Monetary Fund have done is force these countries to tie their hands behind their back, effectively, and to bind them very firmly to an international economy in food. And the consequence of that is that when the price of food goes up, these economies have very little recourse and very little possibility of defending themselves economically.
Raj, you worked at these institutions that you're now critiquing. You worked at the World Bank. You worked at the World Trade Organization. How much contact do you have with people at the other end? For example, the people who are now rising up all over the world, the most destitute.
I certainly don't have any contact with anyone at the World Bank or the World Trade Organization. I was there when I was doing my doctoral work. I did some research for the World Bank. It was a disaster. And I interned at the World Trade Organization just to find out what it was like. But my allegiances are and always have been with the people on the streets. And I'm working right now with shack dwellers in Durban in South Africa. But also I'm connected to groups of peasants and of landless people around the world. By occasionally doing some research for Via Campesina, the international peasant movement that, by some estimates, has over 100 million members. I'm definitely more connected and more supportive of their efforts to develop a more positive and more genuine food democracy.
In your work there, even as a researcher, how much understanding did people who work there have of what was going on and what their institutions were doing?
To some extent, there's a lot of creative denial about the suffering that these organizations cause. I mean, certainly within the World Bank, when I worked there, there was a banner, you know, sort of five stories high as you went into the World Bank building, with a beautiful African child on it, and beneath it the slogan, our dream is a world free of poverty. And certainly there was a sort of myth-making enterprise within the World Bank that everything they were doing was for the benefit of the poor, whether the poor liked it or not. So I certainly think that there's a sense that when things are tough, it's tough love that comes from the World Bank. But I don't think that they're terribly connected to the movements of poor people around the world who are very articulately saying that what the World Bank is doing is actively destructive. And that's, in fact, one of the reasons that Via Campesina, the international peasant movement, started, was because the World Bank was introducing agricultural policy throughout the developing world. But they were doing it without any reference to the farmers' movements that existed, or the movement of landless people that existed. And those movements got together to fight back against the World Bank. And they continue to fight back against the World Bank, and the World Bank has very little, if any, contact with them at all.
Raj, talk about coffee.
The price of coffee is absolutely a function of the way the food system works today. If you look at the path that coffee takes from the field to to our cups, you'll see that the farmers get paid a pittance. The processors get paid a little bit more, sort of 20, 30 cents a kilo. The grain exporters get paid a little bit more, sort of 50, 60 cents a kilo. But by the time it gets processed and turned into instant coffee, it's nearer $30 a kilo. And the people who make the most money out of that process are, you know, the coffee processors, the big international coffee traders, companies like Nestle, for example. And that's indicative of the way the food system works in general. I mean, if you imagine a sort of hourglass, at the top there are the millions of farmers who grow the food that we eat, and at the bottom there are billions of us consumers, and in the middle there are just a handful of corporations that mediate between the people who grow our food and us. And those corporations, in many cases, it's usually four corporations controlling more than 50% of the market. I mean, in tea, for example, one company, Unilever, controls 90% of the market. Now, when you're in that position of market power, you're able to do a great deal. First, you're able to drive prices down for farmers, and of course the irony there is that farmers and farm workers are the poorest people on the planet. So you're paying the poorest people on the planet the least, and then you're processing the food so that what we end up with is food that is rich in salts and fats and sugars, food that tends to make us want to buy more, food that makes us obese. And that's why you're having a situation where there are 6 billion people in the world, a billion of whom are now overweight.
Explain that further, that connection that you actually start your book with. A billion people overweight, 800 million people who are starving, who are hungry, who are not fed enough. Explain the connection.
Well, I mean, in the past, it used to be that the people who are overweight were rich, excuse me, and the people who are